Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Ron Feldman. He's the first vice president and chief operating officer at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. He leads the bank's financial and budgeting operations and strategic planning and is a primary advisor on the Fed's monetary policy. Among other publications, he's the co-author of the book, Too Big to Fail: The Hazards of Bank Bailouts. Ron, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for being here, Grant. I appreciate it.
Well, now, let me just start with a question about sort of the dangers that we might be in as a nation right now in terms of the financial system. You've argued that in recent years the nation has adopted some financial policies that are putting us in greater danger of another financial and banking crisis. And so I want to know if you could, in terms that a non-economist would understand, identify what you think are the two or three most important recent policy changes that prompt you to have this concern. And then we can get into more details as we go.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, let me just try to answer a slightly different question,
sure,
which is, why does someone from the Federal Reserve care about this? Why is this important? So the Federal Reserve is the nation's central bank. So we're responsible for two things in particular. We want to make sure that prices are stable, so we want to make sure that inflation's low. But we also want to make sure that as many people are working as want to work, and we usually call that full employment. Mm-hmm. You can't really have full employment if you're having a financial crisis. I think we all saw that from the last financial crisis that leads over to the rest of the economy. The economy doesn't function very well. So it's super critical for the Fed to try to understand, are we prepared and are we taking steps now to avoid a financial crisis?
Okay.
So what's our concern? So let me say my history here goes back a little bit. So before the financial crisis in 2004, as you mentioned, we wrote a book saying that we had too many big banks that were too risky, and if they got in trouble, we were going to end up bailing them out. And the bailout, even though that's what people focus on, that's sort of after the fact. What you want to do is stop a bailout from happening. So we had a bunch of suggestions, which at the time weren't taken, many of which were taken after the financial crisis. So why are we worried now, even if some of these changes were made? I mean, it really comes down to the following. We don't think that banks have enough financial resources, and there's a bunch of technical names for that. We don't think they have enough financial resources to survive if there's another big hit to the economy. I mean, it's that simple. So in the same way, if you think about your own family, if you don't have enough money in the bank and you lose your job, if that sort of cushion is too small, then the result is going to be bankruptcy and you're going to need help. I think that's really what we're arguing, that big banks don't have enough money themselves in the bank, and if there was a big problem, they would fail, and we'd be right back to where we were before with the American taxpayer bailing them out.
So have there been recent policy changes that have put that situation sort of more likely or more at risk?
Yeah, that's a great question, because we're making really a two-part argument. One is, coming out of the financial crisis, we didn't do enough.
Okay.
And then to make matters worse, so you imagine this. So we're already thinking, boy, we don't have enough money in the bank to take a big hit. Now somebody says, well, let's go party. Let's go reduce the amount of money we have in the bank. Well, that's going to make things worse. And unfortunately, the Federal Reserve and other government agencies are really trying to allow banks to have less of a cushion than they even had before. And that's a concern. So we would have this concern even if that wasn't happening, but it's actually making things worse.
So what would be, if you can do it in ways that non-economists would understand, some of the specific rollbacks or easings that have happened in like the last two or three years, maybe?
Yeah. So it is really complicated, as you said. I think the simplest way to think about it is there's a lot of rules and regulations that basically determine how much do banks have to have as a cushion.
Okay.
And through, I would say, ways that the average person wouldn't really see, but a banker would understand, those cushions are being eroded even slightly. And again, the real problem is, imagine that you don't have enough for a rainy day. And so your solution is, well, I've got a couple of chestnuts put away. I got some peanut butter. I'm going to eat all that, even though I never had enough to begin with. So the real problem is, it's really the combination. There wasn't enough to start with. And now, even though it might not be a large amount, you're reducing the little you have. So it's really perverse.
Is Have there been changes in rules and regulations about what banks can do with that money, with those chestnuts and peanut butter jars that they're emptying?
Yeah, it's a little less than I don't think banks are being allowed to do anything that was more risky than what they could do right after the financial crisis. I think those things are largely the same.
Okay.
It's really I mean, maybe this is another analogy that I think might be helpful. So you have a dam. We're arguing that the dam that the government put into place after the financial crisis wasn't high enough. And what we're doing is, you know, so let's say it's a 100-foot dam. We think you need to have, frankly, for us, to be direct, we think you need to have a 200-foot dam. So we think the 100-foot dam is really, really inadequate. So what's happening now is they're reducing the dam, let's say, to 95 feet, 92 feet. It might not look like a big deal, but since we were already way, way short, on a percentage basis, it's really making things worse. And that's really what's happening. It's happening in lots of small technical ways, but the totality of it is just in the wrong direction.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank's first vice president, Ron Feldman. So I was also curious whether you think that there are particular national or global political or economic conditions or changes in those conditions outside of the things that you're describing about what banks are doing themselves that are also contributing to the risk right now. And some of the things that I've been reading about are the rising levels of household debt or concerns about slowing economic growth around the world or tensions in the world, both political and militarily. So are there things out there on your radar screen that you're thinking, okay, this is really adding to the dam problem that you were describing?
Yeah, you know, I think the way we think about it, so why am I so focused on the dam? Because it's really, really hard to forecast the rain. I mean, maybe that's the way one way to put at it. It's really hard to tell if you're going to get a storm over here or, you know, it's going to be it's going to come because a lake over there is overflowing. All the things you're mentioning, there's always something going on that's the spark. If we tried to stop the spark, I think that's kind of a fool's errand. It's really, really hard. We do our best, and we try to push against the sparks so that there isn't a big fire. But our view is really the most important thing is to thin the forest, maybe to use too many analogies here, or to make sure the dam is high enough, because we're never going to be able to figure out where it's going to happen. So I'm not discounting any of the things. I mean, you mentioned sometimes people talk about student loans. Sometimes people talk about corporations taking on too much debt or it's too risky. Some people will talk about the deficit going up. I mean, some people talk about what's going on with Brexit. There's no end to the number of things. I will say very few people knew that the last crisis was going to come because land values fell by so much. Mm. I don't think people forecasted that prior recessions were from oil shocks, from geopolitical events. So basically, I think our message is you could try to focus on what the cause is going to be. That's really, really hard. Since you don't know the cause, but you know that the end result is if you don't have the dam, you're in big trouble, you should focus on the dam.
So I think, by the way, in terms of the metaphor, we're keeping it pretty consistent here. This is I don't think we're mixing them. So I wonder, though, you ticked off so many things that might be the spark. Do you think there's more of those now than there were in years past?
You know, I mean, so right this second, there looks like there's a lot. I think it's a little bit maybe this is one way to even make the point. So right now you look at the geopolitical stuff around Brexit, or you look around certain of the financial imbalances that sometimes people say that you pointed to, Grant, and it'll seem like this is very unusual. Other times, people are nervous because times look too good. So there's nothing really on the horizon, but because there's nothing on the horizon, they're worried, well, it can't last. We're going to have another recession. So I, is there more today? I mean, there certainly feels like there's a lot right this minute. But even in periods when there's not a lot, I think that we're often getting lulled into a sort of false sense of security. And again, I don't think it's that any of one of those things is going to be an obvious spark, an obvious source of the flood. We're not going to see that coming exactly. But can I say one thing?
Yeah.
The part that I do know is it's going to be something.
Okay.
So that's the part. When you hear people say, well, we're in a new world. It's a new world where this isn't going to happen. You know, it's been happening since Roman times. I mean, if you look back historically, things that hit the financial sector have been with us for very, very long periods of time across all cultures. I mean, if you look at non-Western cultures and you look at historical records, there are things that sound like banking crises. So this is a sort of endemic phenomenon of the human condition in a way. And the idea that we're not prepared for it, that's why it's so, I would say, both frustrating but also so important, because we know something's going to happen and we know that the only way to stop it is to have, if we don't want taxpayers to pay for it, then banks have to pay for it. And the only way banks pay for it is putting aside the money today.
You may have just answered what I wanted to ask as a follow-up to that, and it has to do with uncertainty itself. So, I have read a lot about just the fact that there is uncertainty about the future, that that's its own contributing factor as a spark, the uncertainty in and of itself. You seem to be suggesting that you're pretty certain that it's going to be something. So it's the I guess to use Donald Rumsfeld's sort of terms, it's the unknown knowns, or you know.
Right. Well, so I guess maybe there's two points there. So one is we know there's going to be something. I do think there the idea that when there's a lot of uncertainty, that it does actually sort of raise a little bit of the temperature. So why is that? So when we talk to businesses, they don't want to do investments right now, not because they don't think there's profitable opportunities, but they're not sure exactly what's going to happen. Rather than take the risk, they're holding back. Well, if that's one of the prompts for a recession, then the financial system is going to be vulnerable to that. And Grant, I want to say something I should have said from the beginning.
Sure.
You identified me. You know, I obviously work at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, make sure that institution is operating effectively. But I'm really speaking for myself and for folks at the Minneapolis Fed. I know the Federal Reserve System is a broad entity, including folks in D.C., and I want to be clear, I'm not speaking for them.
The Federal Reserve System is federal.
Exactly, right. It's got a lot of folks working at different aspects of it. I'm just speaking for myself.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Ron Feldman. He's the first vice president and chief operating officer at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and we've been discussing current trends in financial regulations and the concerns about a possible new financial crisis. Ron, I want to go kind of back in time a bit here for a second. You mentioned that the book that you co-authored was 2004, well before the financial crisis, and the book had some warnings about what was going on in the banking industry in that regard. Why do you think – because there were other voices expressing concern. It wasn't the majority view, I guess, at the time, but there were people – why do you think they weren't heeded? Why do you think they weren't taken more seriously?
You know, I wish I had a good answer for that. That is really puzzling. And so, as you just pointed out, there were people outside of government making some comments. Not a lot of people. Not as many people, you know, got it right beforehand as got it right afterwards. Definitely afterwards, there were a lot of people.
That's the way it usually works.
Yeah, that is good. I don't really know. So one reason was there were some legislative changes that had happened after prior banking crises, and many people were vested in the idea that those had fixed the problems. Mm. So that was one issue. There was a general view that financial markets worked really, really well, and so they didn't really need any help. So that was a second kind of view. And the economy looked like it was doing really well, and I think people were reluctant to think that there was a dark side to it. So I think all of those things contributed. I mean, I'm probably the wrong person to ask, right? Since I was someone who thought there was a problem. How about this? When the book came out, we met with senior government officials. It was reviewed in – there's a publication that economists, professional economists contribute to. It was actually reviewed. It was the main book review for that. And generally speaking, people said, yeah, these aren't bad points, but really we're sort of past it.
Hmm. So your bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, has put forward a plan to end this too-big-to-fail problem. So first of all, as you explained the Fed at the beginning, let's just briefly explain what does too-big-to-fail mean?
Right. So too big to fail is the idea that everyone else in the economy, if they make poor financial decisions and they become insolvent, they have to bear the cost themselves. And the idea is that banks are different. And not all banks, not your community bank, not the small banks that operate in upstate New York. We're talking about the Citibanks, the J.P. Morgans, the Bank of Americas, that when they fail, the American taxpayer comes in and makes the people who are owed money whole. So that's the idea that they're too big to fail.
And because if we didn't do that, then that would really send a huge shock through the economy.
That's exactly okay. It. And one thing to be clear about, the focus has to be on preventing the problem from arising. Once a big problem arises in the financial system, there is really no benefit to letting those firms fail. Why is that? Because it's going to bring everybody else down around them. So when you hear people say, well, we're not going to do any advanced planning, don't worry. But when the time comes, we're going to stick to our guns. That doesn't work. It's you have to do something in advance so that when you are actually at the problem, you don't have to save people. Maybe one analogy that Tim Geithner, who was president of the New York Fed, used to say, which is, you don't make a point by once a fire started in someone's house, the firefighters don't come and just let the house burn down. You haven't taught anyone a lesson. What you need to do is make sure that the house is relatively impervious to burning.
So what is the plan for your bank? What are you putting forward as to fix this or end this too big to fail problem?
Right. And so for anyone who wants the details, if you just go to MinneapolisFed.org, you can get it. So there's a lot of details. There's a lot of math. But it's actually really simple. The idea is that we want banks to go out and raise money from investors a lot more than they do today, basically twice as much as they do today. That's often called capital in the banking world. And we want them to have much more of that so that when they get into trouble, the investors are the ones who are going to have to bear the losses. So why are we choosing that? There's lots of different ideas. For example, other people have said, well, just make the banks really small, break them up. Or people will sometimes say a new Glass-Steagall, which is a way of separating one part of the bank from another part of the bank, depending on what they're doing. I think we can talk about those other specific reforms. What we find useful about our proposal is its simplicity. The more complicated you make your proposal during a financial crisis, it's actually not going to work. During a financial crisis, people are doing whatever they can to inject confidence into the system. So what you want to do is have basically investors who have historically taken losses, and that's what these equity investors have done. You want them on the hook. And what we show in our proposal is that actually the economy would be better off if these banks had way more money from investors. One final part, Grant, before we can move on and talk about other parts of this. The banks will argue, well, if you do this, it'll be too costly, we won't lend as much, and the economy will be worse off. So what we show through a bunch of math is the cost of a financial crisis is so huge that if you can stop that, even if banks stopped lending a little bit, the benefits to the American population would overwhelmingly support more investor money at risk, less taxpayer money at risk.
Tell our listeners again where they can go to get more details on
that. So it's at MinneapolisFed.org, or you can just Google Too Big to Fail Plan Minneapolis Fed and you'll get it, or you can Google my name, Ron Feldman, you'll get it. So we've been working on this for a while, so I think you'll be able to see lots of work in this area.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Ron Feldman from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. So in a way, I want to go back again in time, but also think about this more present day as well. But in the lead up to the financial crisis, one of the things that was happening is that people were buying homes they really shouldn't have been buying. And the banks were lending them the money, these subprime mortgages that we read about. How much of the problem can be fixed or avoided by focusing more on the financial responsibility being exercised or even required at the individual level, on the part of individuals pursuing loans and making their financial decisions, as opposed to the larger big financial institutions that are trading those loans and issuing those loans and making those investments? I mean, is it fundamentally an institutional level problem and not a personal responsibility problem?
Right. I mean, so I think maybe there's a couple ways to go at that. So one is, should we take actions today so that households don't make decisions that are actually really harmful to themselves? Yes. And there were reforms to do that. So, for example, banks today have to make sure that someone can actually repay a loan before they can get a loan. I mean, we support that. That's a great idea. Is that going to stop a future banking crisis? No. No. Why is that? Because banks do lots and lots and lots of things and are exposed to lots and lots of things. Banks make loans to people who are building office buildings. Banks make loans to companies who are building factories. Banks make credit card loans. Banks make loans to countries. Banks are super exposed to lots and lots of different things. So even if you could get all households to be prudent and make the decisions that, in some sense, quote unquote, they ought to be, then you would still have banks getting in trouble. So we can't focus on just one part of it.
So you've also been an advocate of the Federal Reserve being a force for a more inclusive economy. That's something that's important to you, I understand. And so tell me a bit about what that means, first of all, what the term means for you, and then how the Fed and monetary policy could be a greater force toward that goal.
Yeah. So one thing we talked about at the beginning of our discussion was, you know, the Fed has some specific mandates that Congress gave us. One of them is that we're supposed to achieve full employment, and that's generally been thought of as everybody who wants a job can get a job. Obviously, if you don't want to work, then you're not going to be part of the equation there. So normally, we just look at the overall unemployment rate to think about whether that's being met or not, and a really high unemployment rate would suggest it's not. But if you look underneath that, you'll see that, for example, African Americans almost always have an unemployment rate that's twice white Americans. And if you look at people who are in rural areas, they might have a different employment experience. People who are young, people without a certain level of education. Those are the kinds of gaps that we don't think are inherent and have to always be there. So what we've done at the Minneapolis Fed is try to bring together scholars, people who are working on a sort of very basic research that might help us solve the problem, try to look at people who have got applied solutions, and try to think about is there a way to address those gaps? So what would an inclusive economy look like? It would look like an economy where there are not such large disparities depending on where you live, what race you are, what ethnicity you are, what gender you are, and certainly things like trying to figure out what kind of education can try to fix that problem, what kind of policies can work, et cetera. So that's really why we're doing it. We view it as really core to our mission and feel like it's something that hasn't got enough attention. And I would say when we started this initiative, at the time, the chair of the Board of Governors, Janet Yellen, I mean, she's been someone who was very, very supportive of this. The current chair, Jay Powell, is very supportive. So even though a lot of this is being housed at the Minneapolis Fed, we view this as something that the whole Federal Reserve is really committed to.
So you're probably tired of hearing the next question that I'm going to ask you, but I'm talking to someone from the Federal Reserve, sure. So there is somebody I have to ask you about, and that is President Trump. He has been very vocal in talking about what the Federal Reserve does. How has his presidency affected your bank and your job and how you approach things or the pressure that you feel?
So, I mean, the Federal Reserve is a public entity, and I think we are open to feedback from the president, from Congress, from all citizens, and I think that's completely appropriate. We're not a private entity. We're a public entity that's working on behalf of everyone. How do we do that? I mean, how do we carry out our job? We're largely a group of exclusively a group of individuals who looks at data, who looks at the charge that we were given, which is try to make sure that prices are stable, tries to make sure that there's full employment. And then we figure out, given the data and given what we're supposed to do, how should we carry out that charge? We don't look at what the politics of the situation are. If someone brings forward data about how we should do our job differently, of course we listen. And so, you know, does that do people love to be criticized? I mean, nobody loves it. But I'll just tell you, the last I've worked at the Fed for the last 22, 23 years, and there's been long, long periods of criticism, some of which has helped us do our job better. So I think we're just very focused on the data. We're very focused on information. We love to get feedback on what we're doing. We're a public entity, and we're just going to move forward. The one thing I would want your listeners to know is we're not affected by it to the degree to which someone is just saying, hey, for my political view or my political goals, here's what you want to do. That doesn't change the data, so therefore it doesn't change what we're going to do. But when people come forward with suggestions about how we ought to do our job differently, of course we listen.
Got a couple minutes left, but I want to shift the terrain a little bit. And you talked before about the recommendation that, to use your metaphor, the dam needs to go from being 96 or 97 feet high to 200 feet high for the banks. That's what you think banks should be doing. What about individuals and families that are thinking about investment decisions, and also businesses that are trying to think about this and what they do you have any advice for them? You're probably in your position loath to do that, but what would you be recommending in a couple minutes?
Yeah. So you know what's interesting, Grant? So we just had in Minnesota, the Minnesota State Fair, which is sounds not like a big deal. It's the biggest gathering of Minnesotans in the state. I think there were 2 million people out of a population of, I don't know, 6, 7 million that attended. It's a big deal. And we were at the fair for the first time. Sort of trying to help people understand what the Fed was about. That was the number one question I got when I was there, the same question. So what did I tell folks? You know, we control short-term interest rates. We have some effect. Boy, I wouldn't have that be the thing that drives your decisions. If you're a household and deciding, should I buy a new house? If you're an individual that's deciding, should I go to college? Those decisions are really driven by the stability of your employment, the fact that education has such a high return. If you're a business, it really probably isn't coming down to our interest rates 2.5% versus 3.5%. It's really, do you have a product that people want to buy? So I don't want to, you know, I love working for the Fed, and the Fed is super important, but people can overstate the things that we control in terms of their own personal decisions. Really, it kind of doesn't really matter. What matters a lot is the core things that, as a family, what are you trying to accomplish? And really, as a business, are you hitting the objectives that you're shooting for?
That was Ron Feldman. Ron, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, it was great, Grant. I'm glad to be back. I'm a Maxwell grad, and I'm proud of it, and I'm glad to be back at Syracuse.
We are glad you're here. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.